Well, thank you, Kelly. Very kind words, but humbling. I think an awful lot of Chad and Kelly and this church and you folks. When we're here, we just feel like we're at home, and so it's great to be here. And I want to say I was really touched when you brought your kids up here, and that almost brought me to tears. Just to see you bless your young people and to pray over them. And I'm a crybaby. Sorry. People at Olathe know that about me. My kids hate it. It's like, oh, Dad's crying again. But I usually try to get through a sermon without crying. I'm probably about 50%. So tonight I'm gonna try not to cry. But the Olathe family from Salina sends greetings, and it's a pleasure really to be with you tonight. Again, I'm humbled to be able to be here and share from the Word, and I appreciate that opportunity. So thank you. For some reason, my mother is a big fan of cruise ships, and I couldn't even tell you all the places my mom has been on a cruise ship. We are very different, Mom and I, and this is one of those areas in which we are different. Being imprisoned on a cruise ship has never appealed to me in the least. When Paul described his trials in 2 Corinthians 11, he listed being beaten with rods, being stoned, spending a night and a day on the open sea, and I wonder why anyone would want to spend 6 days and six nights on the open sea. As you can see, it's not even biblical. And as a pastor, my idea of a vacation is to get away from people, not to be crammed in with people. I'm kidding about that, kind of. But over the years, my mother has said to me many times, "Oh, Sean, I think you would really love a cruise." And I just look at her and I think, "You don't even know me. I'm your son." And I'd say, "I'd sooner be found on the backside of the moon. Never, ever, ever, Mom, I will never, ever go on a cruise." So guess what I just did a couple weeks ago? Guess what I got back from doing, a week ago today? Is that right? And so it was my parents' 50th anniversary celebration. And it'll be 50 years in November, but this was when we could get all the family together. And I was outvoted. So naturally, before we left on this cruise together, I was doing all I could to convince my family that this was a big mistake, and in failing, at least try to ruin it for everyone before we go. So I was watching these YouTube videos with titles like "Five Things Your Cruise Line Doesn't Want You to Know," and 10 things that can go wrong on a cruise ship, and I dutifully reported these to my family. Viruses spread like wildfire on a cruise ship. Criminals, swindlers love to hang out on cruise ships, and they'll get your credit cards and go on a shopping spree at your expense. Did you know that cruise ships are required to have a morgue on them? Because so many people die on cruise ships. So just if you want to die, I guess, go on a cruise. People get drunk, fall overboard into the sea, they drown. Sometimes cruise ships lose power, and they just drift on the waves for days. No food, no lights, toilets don't flush. Well, none of those things actually happened on our cruise, although we did have a mishap with my third oldest son. He he had a ran into a post and had to get stitches, but they have a little mini hospital on board. So really none of those horrible dangers actually materialized. But there was a danger on board that confronted each of us multiple times. A danger that I think we were unprepared for as a family. And I'm being serious now. This was a danger that about halfway through the week, we had to get together and discuss how we would prepare for this danger and prevent ourselves from being from succumbing to this peril. There were 13 floors on this giant cruise ship. I don't know if you've ever been on a cruise ship, a giant cruise ship. And everywhere we went, there was this danger. It was on the mini golf course. It was in the dining room. It was in the fitness room. It was on the glass elevators. It was in the pool. It was everywhere we went. It was in the cabins. It was on the upper deck overlooking the ocean. This danger was lurking everywhere. And it was curious to me that in those YouTube videos that I watched, it was never mentioned, this danger. It didn't appear. And I would have thought that as we got ready to board the cruise ship, that there would have been someone there warning us of this danger. And maybe even having us sign a waiver, releasing the cruise line from liability should we succumb to this. What was the danger? The danger that was worse than losing all your money at the blackjack table, worse than norovirus, worse even than falling overboard, was not a physical danger. It wasn't a danger to body or wallet. It was a spiritual danger, a threat to the soul. It was a deception, a lie that was being told to me at every turn. And the lie was this: you, Sean Meyer, deserve to be treated like royalty. You are a king. It's all about you. You want pizza or you want prime rib? Maybe you want both. There are no limits here. Eat whatever you want. Eat whenever you want. Eat however much you want to eat. If it's 4 p.m. or 4 a.m, someone will be waiting on you. Anything you want, no limits. You in the mood for billiards? You want to sit in the sauna? Whatever is to your pleasing. We have enrichment classes. We'll teach you about yoga. We'll teach you how to be happy. We'll teach you how to be calm. We'll teach you how to meditate. We'll teach you how to get rid of your wrinkles. Whatever you want to do. You can get your nails done. You can get a massage. You feel like laughing? We have a comedian in the auditorium. Whatever you want. Feel like dancing? Meet us on the fourth deck. This is real living. Is it? That was the danger. That was the deception. And I can tell you, honestly, it was a scary thing for me. Not just scary because that temptation was on the cruise ship, but I realized that temptation is a temptation that follows me everywhere. It was only more obvious on the cruise ship, and it allowed me to see myself a little more clearly. That lie, I hate to admit, appeals to me. It appeals to me a lot. There was a cabin maid housekeeping, we were toward the end of our week, we were thinking we need to shed weight to get back without being overcharged for our luggage, and we were actually, because this was a foreign staff, I think 1,100 or 1,200 people from 54 different countries, and so many of them countries that where the gospel is not preached, we thought, let's give away our Bibles. So we were going around asking people, do you have a Bible? Do you have a Bible? And a lot of them didn't have a Bible, and some of them never heard of a Bible, never heard of Jesus. But the lady who cleaned our rooms, she said, "I have a Bible." And she said, in fact, they used to have Bibles in every room. And I assume kind of like a Gideon's Bible. And she said, "But we got so many complaints that we had to remove them." To my knowledge, I don't think the cruise line was requiring people to read their Bibles. So what was it? It's almost as if the Bible itself, just the sight of it, was such a contradiction to the Royal Caribbean, the mentality of a cruise ship, that you have to get that out of there. So is this the real life? Is this the good life? And is this our calling as Christians? And I know I know enough about this church to know that you've heard this kind of message before. And I almost feel silly preaching this to people that I suspect may do a better job of practicing what I'm going to preach than I do myself. But nevertheless, I think this is a message that we need to hear repeatedly, and I know I need to hear it. And so if you don't need to hear it, just humor me as I preach to myself. Fair enough? All right. So the Bible is full of stories of people who sought to live this way, right? Who sought to live like kings and queens who were entitled and should never be denied. And Kelly mentioned Naboth a little bit ago. What was it about King Ahab? You know, it's like, I have to have that vineyard. I have to have it. Or you think of Amnon, you know, the half-brother of Absalom. I have to have that girl. I will not be denied, right? And the story ends the same for both of them. When you were saying he is Naboth, I thought, if I am Naboth, I'm also dead. But thanks. But it's the Bible's full of stories of people who lived that way or sought to live that way. Think of Mrs. Zebedee, right? She comes to Jesus and she says, I have this request. I don't know if she put if the boys put her up to it or what, but she comes and she says, grant that one of these two sons of mine may sit on your right hand and the other on your left when you come in your kingdom. So she wanted this for her sons, and I don't think they were complaining. But the Bible is also full of stories of people who forsook this pursuit. And the first one that comes to mind is Moses. Hebrews 11:24 gives a description of Moses. It says, by faith, Moses, when he had grown up, refused to be known as the son of Pharaoh's daughter. He chose to be mistreated along with the people of God rather than to enjoy the pleasures of sin for a short time. He regarded disgrace for the sake of Christ as of greater value than the treasures of Egypt, because he was looking ahead to his reward. I picture Moses on a Royal Caribbean cruise and probably not fitting in very well. Tonight I want to see what we can learn from a lesser known figure that reminds me a little bit of this description of Moses, someone whose name is unfortunately left out, I think, a lot of times when we talk about Bible heroes. This man was in a similar position, though. It was all within his grasp. We're going to be in chapter 18 of 1 Samuel. And for some context, I want to touch down in chapter 15 just briefly, so I'll give you a second to turn there if you like. After, and I understand you've actually been reading in 1 Samuel recently, right? Okay, good. So after King Saul's disobedience, you'll remember this situation at Gilgal, and Samuel said this to him, 1 Samuel 15:28, the Lord has torn the kingdom of Israel from you today and has given it to one of your neighbors, to one better than you. Importantly, He does not say, the Lord has torn the kingdom away from you and given it to one of your sons. He says, to one of your neighbors. God then sent Samuel to Bethlehem, to the house of Jesse. He had already chosen one of Jesse's sons to reign as king in the place of Saul. So Jesse lines up his seven sons, right? And they go through the list, and no, not him. And it, whoa, is this everybody? Well, the youngest one's still out in the field. Better get him, bring him in. And so Jesse's youngest is called in, was presented before Samuel. Chapter 16, verse 12, it says, then the Lord said to Samuel, that is, rise and anoint him, he is the one. So Samuel took the horn of oil and anointed him in the presence of his brothers, and from that day on, the Spirit of the Lord came upon David in power. The text says that David was anointed and that the Spirit of the Lord was upon him. And it reminds us of when Jesus went into the synagogue in Nazareth, in his hometown, and he read from the scroll of Isaiah, the Spirit of the Lord is on me, he has anointed me. So David is clearly a type of Christ. His kingdom was to point forward to a greater kingdom, and his anointing as king was pointing forward to a greater anointing, of a greater king, the Messiah himself. And so with that in mind, let's jump to chapter 18. And the story is now going to center on a very unlikely relationship. And it is from that relationship that I want to draw some application for us tonight. And the relationship to which I refer is that between David and Saul's son, Jonathan. I think if you ask a lot of people, what is there for us to take away from this story of David and Jonathan? What is it that we draw from that? I think a lot of people would say, well, this is a model friendship. And so we read about this friendship between David and Jonathan, and we try to pattern our relationships in the body of Christ that way, our friendships. And I suppose that could be valid to some degree. But I think if we stop there, we might miss something that's even more important, a lesson here in this story. And so let's look, 1 Samuel 18, and I'm going to start in verse 3. We'll skip around a little bit, but this was right after David killed Goliath and everybody was celebrating, even Saul. It says, Jonathan made a covenant with David because he loved him as himself. Jonathan took off the robe he was wearing and gave it to David along with his tunic and even his sword, his bow, and his belt. And I'm going to come back to this and comment on it a little later. But this, here's the royal situation so far in 1 Samuel. Saul is still in power, but he's losing his grip on the kingdom. God's favor has left him, and the more that Saul tries to grab onto his power and hold it, the more pitiful he becomes. There's a story about when he went down to Naoth, and he's going to try to kill David there, and he ends up naked for a whole day, and he's just a spectacle at this point. The futile aim of holding on to power at this point is literally driving him insane. And there's a contrast because it says that everything David puts his hand to succeeds. Of course, we know that the Lord is with him. But Saul, on the other hand, everything he puts his hand to is an embarrassing failure. Back to Jonathan. Now, before we talk about this relationship with David, let's talk about Jonathan a little bit. He's Saul's firstborn son, and what do you call the firstborn son of a king? Yeah, the heir, right. He's the heir to the throne. He's the prince, right? Here's something else that I think we should realize about Prince Jonathan. I think a lot of times when we imagine this, we think of David and Jonathan kind of as equals in terms of age. I Googled David and Jonathan just to see some of the artwork that has been made that would depict them. And a lot of times it looks like two guys, maybe late teens, early 20s. Is that what you've kind of always imagined or thought of? Well, the Bible tells us that David was 30 years old when he became king. That's in 2 Samuel 5. He was anointed many years earlier, obviously, but he didn't take the throne until after Saul's death when he was 30. Because Saul reigned 40 years, we know then that David was born about the 10th year of Saul's reign. Now, 3 years into Saul's reign, which would have been 7 years before David was born, we have Jonathan leading, commanding an army of 1,000 men. And you had to be at least 20 years old to even serve in the army of Israel. So to be a commander, I would think maybe a little older, not sure. But this would put Jonathan at 27 years older than David at this time. And somebody might say, well, maybe they made an exception. They let Jonathan in a little early. I don't know. I'm not sure. That could be. But I would think that of all people, you don't want to send the prince in unprepared. So I think 20 is probably a good guess. In any case, these were not two teens or two guys in their early 20s. These were not buddies. This is more like, in terms of the age difference, more like father-son. And here's why that matters. It matters. If David was 20-ish and Jonathan was 47, in those days, we can think of a lot of examples of, you're in 1 Kings now, is that right? We can think of lots of examples of would-be kings killing off any potential rivals to the throne, right? You think of the story of Abimelech. He kills 70 of his brothers to preserve the throne for himself. Jonathan, at 47, already a powerful military leader, successful military leader. You can go back to chapter 14 and read about his bravery and his exploits. He was famous in Israel, and probably in the minds of everyone, the next king. And maybe even in his own mind. Maybe Jonathan, from the time he was little, you know, especially if he had sisters, they would have been dressing him up in a little king outfit, right? Maybe putting a little fake crown on his head and a tiny scepter. But he had probably been told for the previous 40 years, you're going to be king. And now, here's David. Jonathan's late 40s, mid to late 40s. Here comes David, this young guy, and he's going to take it from him. Jonathan, of all the people on the earth, I think would be the least likely candidate even to befriend David, much less intervene and save his life as he did on several occasions. And in so doing, mystified Saul, right? Saul could not understand it. He was obsessed with power. He couldn't understand why Jonathan didn't have the same aspirations. Consider this exchange that took place at the New Moon Festival when Saul learned that Jonathan was actually protecting David. That's in 1 Samuel 20, verse 30. It says, Saul's anger flared up at Jonathan. He said to him, don't I know that you have sided with the son of Jesse to your own shame and to the shame of the mother who bore you? As long as the son of Jesse lives on this earth, neither you nor your kingdom will be established. Now send and bring him to me, for he must die. And I would guess that this probably had less to do with Saul thinking about Jonathan and more to do with him thinking about his own dynasty and his own name. But Jonathan's actions show him to be a man of remarkable character. Someone might try to explain his actions as owing to ignorance, maybe, concerning David's future claim on the throne. But if we jump back in chapter 20 to verse 12, we see Jonathan was fully aware of David's destiny. And this was as Jonathan and David were kind of devising this scheme to figure out, is my dad really going to kill you, David, or wanting to kill you? And I don't know how by this time that couldn't have been obvious. But Jonathan says, if my father is inclined to harm you, may the Lord deal with me, be it ever so severely, if I don't let you know and send you away safely. May the Lord be with you. This is key. May the Lord be with you as he has been with my father. But show me unfailing kindness like that of the Lord as long as I live, so that I may not be killed. And do not ever cut off your kindness from my family, not even when the Lord has cut off every one of David's enemies from the face of the earth." You think he didn't know? "May the Lord be with you as he has been with my father." This is a way of saying, may God establish your kingdom. Jonathan's loyalty to David wasn't due to him being naive to David's destiny. Quite the opposite. It was because he recognized David as the king elect, so to speak. He was profoundly aware of that fact. Chapter 23, verse 17, he says, "My father Saul will not lay a hand on you. You will be king over Israel, and I will be second to you." So Jonathan recognized the Lord's anointed. He gladly accepted God's will and the fact that he himself was not destined to sit on the throne, in spite of everything he had always been told. Now back to us. We could look at this and say, what an inspiring example of friendship here between David and Jonathan. And that's good. I think there's something to be said for that. But I think there's more. If David is a type of Christ, and he prefigures and points forward to Christ, then who is Jonathan? Does he not represent what a faithful disciple should look like? So the question for me is this: am I a modern version of Saul, vainly clinging to something that is being ripped away from me, and in the process making a spectacle of myself? Or am I like Jonathan, knowing my true place and refusing to grab onto what is not rightfully mine? I want to point out three things in Jonathan that I want to see more of in myself, three things that I think you probably want to see more of in yourself if you're a disciple of Christ. Having recognized David as the Lord's anointed, first of all, Jonathan realized that he was not in charge. If David is king, then Jonathan isn't calling the shots. And knowing that this is where I wanted to go tonight with this message, it struck me how what we sang earlier just really fit in and what Chad prayed earlier. Jesus is Lord. He's king and he's Lord. In other words, you're the boss. Jonathan said, "You will be king over Israel. I will be second to you." And isn't this the attitude that we should display toward Jesus, the king? And Jesus was very direct in his claim to kingly authority, right? Matthew 28, the Great Commission, he mandated that what is taught to these disciples is that they obey him. He didn't say go out and make converts, that's implied, obviously, but teach them to obey everything that I've commanded you. He describes himself as a king sitting on a throne of authority. He says in John chapter 14, if you love me, you'll obey me. And so Jesus isn't shy about saying, I want obedience. He is a king. And as a king, he has the right to tell us what to do, where to go, how to live. And it helps me, maybe it helps you too, but it helps me to remember that this particular king has my best interests at heart. Okay? He's not like other kings whose commands often reflect a desire to exploit their subjects, right? That's not this king. This king, any command he gives us is good for us. We need to remember that. We aren't mere subjects in his mind. But still, I think it's a hard thing for us. It's a hard thing for me. I want to be in charge. I want to be the one calling the shots. And I think mostly that's my sinful nature, but I also think some of it is cultural. I think some of it's environmental. I think we grow up in this world, especially here in the West, where everything in us and everything that we encounter kind of encourages this mentality that you do your thing, you do what you want, you're in charge, you call the shots. Do you think that's the case? We just, We just live in this cruise ship mentality, right? Go where you want. Do what you want. You see it. I used to, every now and then I would speak in schools, public schools, I'd see these banners, like, you know, and the banners were always like, you do your thing. You know, you're autonomous. We grow up, that's the air we breathe. It's cruise ship mentality. Maybe similar to Jonathan's situation, you know, people dressing him up as a king. People dress us up as kings. And so I think this should be our prayer. Father, don't let me be tricked by that. Don't let me be deceived by that. That's the world's thinking. Secondly, Jonathan seemed to realize that he was not the one deserving of attention. The glory belongs to the true king, not the make-believe kings. The glory belongs to the true king. Remember what he did when he made this covenant with David back in chapter 18. I said we'd come back to this. So he makes this covenant with David. It says in verse 4 of chapter 18, Jonathan took off the robe he was wearing and gave it to David along with his tunic and even his sword, his bow, and his belt. And I think we can easily read past that and miss the significance of it. Jonathan's robe and his tunic and his sword and his bow and his belt, these are not common items. And yes, there people wore robes and tunics back then, obviously, but they weren't royal robes and royal tunics, okay? I think these were royal garments. I think they were probably recognizable as such. I don't think these were common things. And so for him to take those and turn them over and say, David, I want you to have this. I don't want this. I don't want to be seen with this. I think that's significant. Think about that sword. That wasn't just any old sword. At one point, it was one of only two swords in all of Israel because the Philistines had gotten rid of all the blacksmiths. They wanted to squash any revolt. And so only Saul and Jonathan had swords. And now Jonathan's saying, here, David, you take this sword. Once he met and recognized the true king, that sword didn't belong to him anymore. This was a complete and joyful surrender, both of the kingdom and of the glory. Jonathan now understood his role. His role was really just in helping to prepare the way for the new king, the true king. And how can that not remind us of someone who came along centuries later bearing the same name? You know who I'm talking about, John the Baptist, right? Who stated this, "A man can receive only what is given him from heaven. You yourselves can testify that I said, I am not the Christ, but am sent ahead of him. The bride belongs to the bridegroom. The friend who attends the bridegroom waits and listens for him and is full of joy when he hears the bridegroom's voice. That joy is mine, and it is now complete. He must become greater. I must become less." We're talking about glory here. And I think we need to join John the Baptist. We need to join his Old Testament namesake and say, glory to the true king, not to me. We must become greater. He must become less. And boy, I wish there was a way that I could just do that once and for all, right? And just when I'm in the right mindset and when I have the right frame of mind, just say, glory to Jesus, not to me. There, that settles it. But I get into that mindset, and then it takes me about 3 seconds to get back to glory seeking, right? And so I think we need to wake up every day and say, God, let me use this life to glorify you. I I see all the ways that I do this, try to get attention onto me. I'd be embarrassed to list them. But I'm guessing maybe some of you could relate to some of it. And I just think we need the power of the Holy Spirit to just keep reminding us. Not about us. Kids even do this, by the way, right? Have you noticed that how kids want glory? Even little kids. What do they say when they're out there on the trampoline? Dad, look, Dad, watch me. Watch me do this, Dad, watch, watch. And we might say, oh, that's all innocent. I think for the most part it is. But I think there's something in it. I want those eyeballs on me. Watch me jump off the diving board. It starts early and it doesn't go away. It just gets worse. You might think, oh, it gets better because I don't do that anymore. Oh, we do other things as adults. We get better at hiding it. I know it's in me. I know it is. People in the cruise ship, they know it. They recognize it. And they make money off of it. Everywhere I turn around on that cruise ship, somebody was there to take my picture, right? Yeah, it's because I look like a model. They're taking everybody's pictures. Everywhere you go, people taking pictures of you. Like, what's the deal? Well, at the end of the week, they had a room. Ask my wife if you think I'm exaggerating. It was probably as big as this room or bigger of all these like dividers with pictures, just thousands of pictures all around. And you could go and look. Oh, there I am. There I am. There I am. And I can buy that for only $20. I can buy this picture of myself. But here's why I want to buy it. I look really good. I'm not kidding you. They take the picture and they Photoshop it. Not with my permission. They Photoshop it ahead of time so that I look at it and go, wow, I didn't even know I looked that good. I'm not kidding. They take out the wrinkles. They make you look 10 years younger. It's not a joke. If you think I'm making this up, it's for real. They see it. They know that we're glory seeking. Why does it work? Why does it work? Would it work? Would it work on Jonathan if Jonathan was on a cruise ship? Jonathan, ready and eager to deflect glory to where it really belongs. I want to be like Jonathan. I want to say, I can't wear this stuff. I can't wear the royal stuff. Part of my sanctification as a disciple of Jesus is a growing desire to see the King glorified in the eyes of man. And if others are going to see the King glorified, then I got to step out of the way. I got to get out of the way so people can see him. The King is in charge. The King gets the glory. And finally, number three, the King is in control. When Jonathan understood that David was king, he threw himself at David's mercy, realizing that David would decide his fate. He said, show me unfailing kindness like that of the Lord as long as I live, so that I may not be killed. And do not ever cut off your kindness from my family, not even when the Lord has cut off every one of David's enemies from the face of the earth. Realizing who David is, Jonathan anticipates that he is going to be in a position to protect him. He has faith that God will eliminate all of David's enemies, which would have included his own father. I think you and I live in uncertain times. And this realization that Jesus is the King has many benefits for us. It's okay that we can't defend ourselves against the uncertainties of life, against the tragedies of life. It's okay that we're not ultimately in control. I think it's okay that we're not self-sufficient. It's okay, because we have a King who is. And this might even be the hardest one for me. But knowing that the King is in control, we can wake up every day, we can live in confidence, we can follow him in confidence, not thinking, should I obey? What's the risk? We don't have to weigh that out. We can just follow him. What kind of king is this, anyway, that we're supposed to yield to and follow? And I think that's a question that really matters. What kind of king is this? At Aletheia, we sing a song, and maybe you sing it sometimes here too. Goes, "Amazing love, how can it be that you, my king, would die for me?" A king dying for his subjects. What kind of king is this? You know, David sent Uriah in to die for him, right? And that's what kings do. You go die for me. What kind of king dies for his subjects? What kind of king is this? To Zebedee's sons and the other disciples who wanted that power and that glory, Jesus said this, "Whoever wants to become great among you must be your servant, and whoever wants to be first must be your slave, just as the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many." That's what kind of king this is. This is a king who doesn't ask us to do anything that he wasn't willing to do, right? Life was not a cruise ship for Jesus. So why should it be for us? And how remarkable is this fact that it's not Moses and it's not Jonathan and it's not John the Baptist that is the ultimate example of humility. It's the king himself, who though all was in his grasp, he released his grip on glory for our sakes, who being in very nature God, did not consider equality with God something to be grasped, but made himself nothing, taking the very nature of a servant, being made in human likeness and being found in appearance as a man, he humbled himself and became obedient to death, even death on a cross. Therefore, God exalted him to the highest place and gave him the name that is above every name, that at the name of Jesus every knee should bow in heaven and on earth and under the earth. Surely then, we look to Jonathan as someone whose example we should not only imitate, but whose example we should want to imitate. We should want to be like Jonathan for this king who died for us and who gave up his grip on glory for our sakes. Surely we should want that. God help us.